You are a sinner who has rejected God, and God in his mercy has sent his son to die for you and rescue you. Believing that truth transforms everything. And yet our familiarity with it often means it loses its significance, that sense of wow or shock. And we become like seasoned paramedics, like a good friend of ours who's they're no longer shocked by horrific injuries. That sense of seeing the same things, however shocking, can become just familiar. When that happens spiritually, it leads to spiritual complacency, a lack of spiritual fervor or vigor, decreased desire to serve, love for others becomes a struggle, your willingness to fight sin, to make every effort to put your sinful nature to death, diminished. And over time, you'll drift. You might even give up on Christ altogether. And the Bible records Christ's death, his trial, not just that we come to faith, but that we continue in the faith. That we keep seeing the wonder of what Christ has done for us. So I'm going to pray this morning that as we look at these accounts, we wouldn't just see. We wouldn't just think, yeah, I know this. But that we would savor and treasure it, that would be transformed and humbled by these events that mark us as believers. So let me pray now that that would be the case. Father, as we come to these passages over these coming weeks, but as we do so this morning, these passages that are often familiar to us, maybe we've heard as believers for 20, 30, 40 years. We've heard them and seen them and read them. They're familiar. But Father, we pray you this morning, you'd help us to see afresh, that we would savor and behold and treasure what it is Christ is done for us, is doing for us, that we would believe and be transformed, humbled, repentant, thankful. So give us eyes to behold the beauty of your word now, we ask. In Jesus' name, amen. If we're going to see how beautiful Christ's death is and its significance for us, you need to see how wicked humanity is, how wicked we are. A month or so ago, the news reported that the top cardinal in Australia, remember the story? The third highest ranking member in the Catholic Church, a close advisor to the Pope, was convicted of abusing children in horrific ways. As I read the reports, alongside the wickedness of the acts was the hypocrisy. That this man, this cardinal, had overseen investigations into other abusers in the church and had let them off. He was the perpetrator turned judge. Here he was sitting as judge over others like him who had abused children. But worse, was he was in effect judge over the victims. The very one who should have been judged is sitting in judgment on these poor, innocent children who had been abused. And in his declaration of the ones who should have been condemned and setting them free, he condemns the innocent. He, in effect, declares them guilty, declaring that what these children have said to be not true. How utterly wicked. Now imagine, like me, that kind of stirs an outrage within you. Now how could this guy who is abusing become the judge and set the guilty free? and allow the innocent to continue enslaved, punished as it were, as if they'd done something wrong. And yet in our passage, we see an even greater wickedness. I mean, maybe you're thinking, is there an even greater wickedness? Yes, look at this. God's innocent king is on trial by guilty humanity. Have a look at verses 66 to 71 with me. Jesus, we read in those preceding verses, has been mocked, he's been beaten, he's been blindfolded, he's been insulted, and now he stands before the council of the elders of the people, verse 66, the chief priests and the teachers of the law. It's all the leaders of the Jewish people. It's a supposed trial, but it's a sham. Jesus has already, we learn from the other Gospels, been tried by Annas and Caiaphas, the high priests. The decision has already been made. But the law, the rules meant the official verdict must be made in daylight, not in the darkness of the night. It required all the leaders. So here they were going through the motions, questioning, seeking to trick Jesus for him to confess he's a king, not because they think he's God's king, but they want him to confess to being regal, opposed to Rome, that they might kill him. So verse 67, if you are the Messiah, they say, tell us. Jesus, well aware of their purposes, their motives, responds, if I tell you, you will not believe me. If I asked you, you would not answer. Similar to the way he responded to the question about John the Baptist back in chapter 20, where he says, you know, I'll answer your question if you answer mine. Is John from God or from man? And like then, Jesus knows their answer. He knows they won't engage. He knows they've made up their minds. He knows their only concern is to kill him. They're not bothered with the truth. All they want to do is protect their authority, their comfort, their plans, their position as leaders. Just like the cardinal, sitting in judgment, protecting himself, not concerned with justice. But then Jesus says something utterly staggering, which reveals the wickedness of what is happening in pretty much the only words he speaks in this whole trial, verse 69. But from now on, the Son of Man will be seated at the right hand of the mighty God. See what Jesus is saying? The right hand is the place of authority. The one who sits there is given all authority by mighty God, including the authority to judge all mankind. Here is the Son of Man, the Messiah, the King, Jesus, and he is the one who has all authority. And though Jesus is before the council as an arrested man, it is Jesus who will sit at God's side, vindicated, and he, not the council, who will be the judge. I mean, here they are thinking themselves all powerful and clever as they stand in judgment over the judge, God's king, at their little mock trial. And if only they had the eyes to see who truly stood before them, and they should have. But they were blind, blinded by their own need for power and status and rule and desire to rule themselves. And Jesus' words reveal the wickedness of this trial and of the trials that will continue before Pilate and Herod. Oh, we felt the outrage at the cardinal's actions, judging innocent victims. Here's an even greater evil. The Creator is on trial by those he created. The innocent, perfect man, the one who has never done anything wrong, the one who has come to save, who has healed and restored many, is being judged by those who are wicked and rebellious and who oppose his righteous rule, who are seeking to kill him, rejecting his kingship. This is God's king on trial by guilty humanity, by those who one day he will judge. And we hear that And we're rightly outraged, we're appalled, we're offended. How could they do that? But I want to add one more little word to that sentence, God's King on trial by our guilty humanity. And it's the word us. It's easy to see the wickedness of that trial, but not see how we're just like them. That every time I wave my puny little fist at God, rejecting his kingship in favor of my own desires and rule, I'm just like them. I remember age 12 making that initial profession of faith, but coming home in tears because I did not want God to rule my life. Kind of taking back my words because I was scared to surrender the little autonomy I had because I thought I knew best. I was in effect waving my puny little fist at God. Maybe that's a version of you this morning. Now, you come each week, but you sit there thinking, I can't follow a God who allows suffering in this world. I can't follow a God who does not allow same-sex marriages. I can't follow a God who will judge all. I can't follow a God who does not allow me to do what I want. I can't follow a God who says there's only one way to be saved. And as you wave your puny little fist, you're sitting there putting the God of the universe on trial. You're choosing to judge God rather than submit to the one who one day every knee will bow before. You sit there as if you somehow you know best, that your answers are wiser, that somehow you know all things and can understand all things, that you can make sense of all that is happening because you know best. And you wave your puny little fist at God. Believer, every time you sit there, you allow yourself to think, God, you're wrong to allow this in my life. You're wrong to have ruled in this way. You're in effect putting God on trial as if to say, Lord, the way in which you have decreed to rule your world, the things that you have allowed in my life, the hard times, the sifting, the refining, you are wrong to do so. And I know better with the limited knowledge that I have. Every time we do that, we're saying, just like this council, you're not king, we are. You're not the judge, we are. And you're putting God on trial. What a wicked and evil thing to do. But things get worse. Maybe you're thinking, can things get worse? Yes, it's not just that they and we stand in judgment over God. We reject Christ and reject his rule. See, not only is God's king on trial, God's king is rejected by guilty humanity. Have a look with me, verse 70 onwards. Verse 70, the leaders ask, are you the Son of God? Once more, knowing their intentions, Jesus neither denies or affirms. He says, you say that I am. Verse 71, they rightly understand his claim to divinity and are pleased with themselves. Why do we need any more testimony? We've heard it from his own lips. And so the whole assembly, verse 1, note how Luke is underlining all the leaders are rejecting Jesus as they lead him off to Pilate. Before Pilate, they lay out three charges, verse 2. The first charge, we found this man subverting or misleading our nation. Lie. Jesus was sent from God and had come to show the nation God's ways. The leaders clearly rejected that. Their second charge, he opposes payment of taxes to Caesar. Lie. In fact, Jesus had demonstrated and taught the complete opposite in Luke chapter 20, verse 20. Third charge, He claims to be Messiah, a king, true, but not in the sense the Jews are spinning it as they choose to reject God's king. Pilate sees through it all. He gets to the heart of the matter, verse 3. Are you the king of the Jews? Clearly, Jesus had not been stirring the whole nation up or opposing taxes. Pilate would have heard of it. Barabbas was in jail for such actions, verse 19. No, Pilate sees what's happening. He sees right through it. This is an internal power struggle. Jesus' response is a tacit affirmation, but is expressed with a qualification about the way the question is perceived. You say so. Jesus is a king, but he's not out to overthrow Rome. Pilate is convinced Jesus is no threat, verse 4, but the leaders insist, verse 5. He stirs up the people all over Judea by his teaching. He started in Galilee and has come all the way here. Pilate sees a way out. This man falls under Herod's jurisdiction. Send him to Herod. Herod is excited to see Jesus. He's hoping to be entertained with miracles, verse 8. He plies him with questions. Jesus is silent. Just as Isaiah 53 had foretold, and we sung this morning, as a sheep is silent before its shearers, so he did not open his mouth. The chief priests and the teachers of the law, verse 10, stand there vehemently accusing him. Herod, not getting anything out of Jesus, rejects him and instead creates his own entertainment by ridiculing and mocking Jesus' kingship, dressing Jesus in an elegant robe, verse 11. Luke records, verse 12, that day Pilate and Herod became friends, fulfilling Psalm 2. The kings of the earth rising up and the rulers banding together against the Lord and against his anointed. As they reject Jesus. Verse 13, Pilate now calls together the chief priests, the rulers, and the people. Note how things are escalating. The people are included. Now it's not just the leaders who are present who are rejecting Jesus. Now the whole nation gathers. Pilate gives his verdict, verse 14, I find no basis for your charges against him, nor does Herod. He's done nothing to deserve death. Pilate seeks to compromise, verse 16, I'll punish him and release him. Verse 18, the whole crowd, just as it was the whole assembly, verse 1, now it's the whole crowd, it's the whole nation, as it were, shouting, spurred on by the leaders. I imagine there were many that day in the crowd unsure of what was happening and why, but were caught up in the sway of emotion. They're chanting with the others, away with this man, release Barabbas. Seeking to take advantage of a little tradition where a prisoner was pardoned at the Passover festival. And so they seek Barabbas to be freed, an actual insurrectionist and murderer who has actually stirred up the nation, and for Jesus to take his place. Pilate appeals to them, wanting to release Jesus, verse 20, but they keep shouting, crucify him, crucify him, crucify him. For the third time, verse 22, Pilate speaks to them, why? What crime has this man committed? I'll have him punished and then released him. Verse 23, but with loud shouts, they insistently demanded that he be crucified. Crucify him, crucify him, crucify him. And their shouts prevail. Verse 24, Pilate decided to grant them their demand, releasing Barabbas. And note this, and he surrendered Jesus to their will, to what they wanted. Pilate, in the end, rejects Jesus. The leaders reject Jesus. Herod rejects Jesus. The whole nation rejects Jesus. God's king is rejected by guilty humanity. And it's not that what took place was an accident. It's not that the leaders and the crowd just made a mistake. It's not that they just got the wrong guy. Luke doesn't leave you with that as an option. Luke makes clear they understood the claims of divinity, of messiahship. They'd witnessed Jesus' miracles. They'd heard his teaching. They'd seen something of who he was. And they had purposefully, intentionally, wickedly rejected God's king. God's very own son. God's king is rejected by guilty humanity. Here's the thing. And he's rejected by us. If we had been there, we'd have done the same. We would have cried with the crowd, "Crucify him." We'd have willed him to death. How do I know we would have? Because each of us has rejected him or is rejecting him. Maybe we've rejected him like Pilate did, out of fear, cowardliness, not prepared to stand apart, not prepared to stand up for Jesus, fearing what others will say or think, fearing their response to us. Oh, we know who Jesus is. We know he's the king, but we're too afraid to follow him. Fearing what our family will think, fearing that they'll reject us, fearing our work colleagues, fearing our school friends. So we take the easy path and we choose to reject Jesus, even though we know the truth. Maybe you reject him like Herod did. When Jesus doesn't give us what we want, when he doesn't entertain us, we get bored with him. Oh, we come to church each week, we enjoy the service, we sing new nice songs, we like the company, we get free coffee and every now and then donuts, praise God, but we're getting bored. It's time to move on. It's not doing it for me anymore. Maybe it takes a more subtle form of Herod. Oh, we want Jesus when we have a need, when we want him to provide for us, when we want him to make our lives more comfortable, more successful. Lord, help me at work. Please would I be blessed. Please would I get that promotion. Please would I have the bigger house. Please would you help me with my family. But then we discover Jesus wants more for us. More than just to be like a genie, he wants a relationship with us. Now that's too much. I'm happy with Jesus kind of being there to answer my needs, but to follow Jesus, to lay down my life for Jesus, no way. So I reject him. He doesn't do it for me. Maybe like your many in the crowd that day, just getting caught up in what others think. Oh, the world says Jesus is not God. The world says there is no God. There's no creator. We're just here by chance. And we get caught up in what the world thinks. And we go with the flow. And we never stop to think, what do we really think? We never stop to weigh Jesus' words and teachings. We just reject him along with everyone else. Or maybe you're like the leaders. You reject him even though you see the truth of who he is. Even though you know his teachings and the hope he holds out. But you don't want him to rule us. You don't want his authority over you. Like me as a 12-year-old boy, you like living the way you live, doing things how you want them, when you want them, using your time and your money your way. So we reject him. Rejecting his rightful authority and kingship over us. And even as believers, there are days, aren't there, when my sinful nature gets the better of me and I reject Jesus, choosing to live as if I'm still in charge, doing things my way. Maybe because I'm scared like Pilate, fearing what others think. If I do what is right, others will mock me. If I speak up for Jesus, they'll tease me, and so you keep quiet. Maybe you reject like Herod because things aren't working out how you want them to, expect them to, demand them to. So you do what you want. Maybe like the crowd, you just going along with the others, not wanting to be different. Maybe like the leaders, just wanting to rule your little world for me, just in that little area. I'm quite happy with Jesus ruling over here, but this area I'm going to keep. How are you rejecting Jesus? Who are you most like? Herod? Pilate? The crowd? The leaders? And yet, even as guilty humanity rejects its maker, rejects God's king, it's all part of God's plan. Foretold centuries before, the Old Testament had foretold this would happen. Isaiah 53, Psalm 2. Psalm 22 foretells God's king being scorned, despised, mocked, insulted by God's people. Psalm 69 speaks of the scorn and the shame that God's king would endure as he sought to honor God. Jesus himself predicted his rejection three times. He told his disciples he'd be handed over to the Gentiles, that they would mock him, insult him, spit on him, flog him, kill him. And so that now, even as Jesus stood before a guilty humanity, Jesus is in perfect control. And yet, if man has treated God this way, and Jesus is in perfect control, how will God respond? What will he do to people who wave their puny little fists? What's going to happen? What's next in the plan? And the response is startling. I mean, I know what I would do if I was Jesus at this point. But not him. See, God's innocent king dies for guilty humanity. He dies for us. I don't know whether you noted as we went through the trials, the number of times that Luke makes clear that Jesus is innocent. I counted seven times Luke either implicitly or explicitly tells us Jesus is innocent. Have a look. Verse 4, Pilate announced, "I find no basis for a charge against this man." Verse 14, "I've examined him and find no basis for your charges against him." Then again, verse 15, "Neither has Herod." And again, verse 15, "He has done nothing to deserve death." Verse 20, wanting to release Jesus. Why? Because he's innocent. Verse 22, "What crime has this man committed? I found him no grounds for the death penalty." Verse 25, "He released Barabbas, a known man for insurrection and murder, and he surrendered Jesus to their will." Can it be clearer? Jesus is perfectly innocent. He's done nothing deserving of death. Verse 69 is God's verdict. He'll be seated at the right hand, fulfilled in his resurrection and ascension. Jesus is perfectly innocent. And yet he dies. Why? It's all in the story of Barabbas. Barabbas, this little man who keeps being mentioned, verse 18 and verse 25. It's like a worked example for us. See, what Jesus does there in taking Barabbas' place is a picture of what he's about to do for all who would ask him. Just imagine Barabbas with me for a moment. In fact, put yourself in his shoes for a moment. Now, you're Barabbas, okay? You're sitting in a Roman jail awaiting your death. You know, deep down, you will be crucified for the crimes you have committed. Twice Luke's told us he's known for insurrection and murder. And you're sitting there in jail, and you know death is coming, and in your most honest moments, you know you deserve it. You know you've done wrong. You know you murdered those men. You know, you led a rebellion. Now, there aren't many worse ways to die. And so day after day, as you sit in jail, you're anticipating the nails, the mockery. I mean, you've seen others crucified. You know it's excruciating pain. The blood filling your lungs. The breaking of your legs. You know your future. I mean, you don't know when it's coming, but you know it is coming. Then you hear a mob outside. Something's going on. Has word gone out that today is your day to die? It sounds like it. You can hear the crowd screaming, crucify him, crucify him. Now imagine what Barabbas is thinking. Finally, the Roman guards come and get you. Now you know. And they drag you out in front of the angry mob. And they set you completely free. And as you stand there, you watch another man stumble off under the weight of the cross, the cross you had pictured yourself carrying, and you discover as you ask some bystanders that it was him that demanded to be crucified. It was him that the shouts had been directed at, not you. And you ask, you know, what was he done? And you expect to hear, well, he's a huge murderer, insurrectionist, he's done everything, he's the most wicked man ever. But the people near you, they're surprisingly hazy about what he's actually done. We don't really know what he's done, actually. But they chose you to live, they say, and him to die. Somehow you're going free because that man's going to die. Jesus bore the guilt and shame and the curse and the disgrace and the death that Barabbas deserved, while Barabbas received the release and the freedom of life that Jesus deserved. Barabbas is free and Jesus is condemned. And the truth is, we're really all just like Barabbas. We're sinners. You know, we sit in a spiritual prison, bound and helpless, awaiting the day when we get the just punishment that we deserve for our insurrection, our rebellion against the King, the Maker, for our murder of an innocent man. And in our most honest moments, we know we're guilty. We know we never quite lived how God had demanded. But then Jesus goes off to the cross in our place and he gets what we deserve, the guilt and the shame and the curse, and we get what he deserved, freedom to live with God. That's the glory of the cross. That God the Father sent God the Son. It was his plan that his Son would die for women and men like Barabbas, women and men like us, who put God's King on trial, who reject God's King, and he saves us. Ultimately, Jesus didn't die because Pilate was a coward and was too weak. He didn't die because the religious leaders hated him. He died because you and I are weak. And because we rejected him and we have hated him in our hearts, and because he loves us. And friends, we won't grasp the events of Good Friday next week, or 2,000 years ago, as it were, unless we stand in Barabbas's shoes and find that they perfectly fit us. How will you respond? Humbly, proudly, repentant, unrepentant, thankful, unthankful? Let it just blow over in familiarity. Or will it cause you to stand in wonder and awe and amazement once more? Will it lead to a transformed life? A life that seeks to follow wholeheartedly King Jesus, seeking to give him our all, to throw, as it were, our little crowns aside and to bow before his kingship? See, those who see, who truly see who Jesus is and what he's done, that God's innocent King died for guilty humanity, will give up all desire to rule their own lives and humbly submit to a better rule under a better king. That's why Paul writes in Galatians, and I've been crucified with Christ. I no longer live. The life I live in the body, I live by faith in the Son of God who loved me and gave himself for me. The one who sees Jesus will willingly crucify daily their own desires, their own wills. They'll fight sin. They'll put to death sinful natures, because I no longer live, but Christ lives in me. and I want to follow wholeheartedly. I'm not going to reject out of fear or boredom or pressure or simply to rule myself again, but I'm going to seek to follow each day, looking to Jesus every day, never bored with what Christ has done for me, allowing it to shape every decision, every thought, every action, and so never losing my spiritual vigor or fervency. And if you're not following Jesus, what will you do? Because Jesus has been given all authority. One day he will judge, and one day you will stand before him, the one you have rejected. And on that day, if you are still rejecting him, still waving your puny little fist at him, if you are still thinking that somehow you know best, he will give you the desires of your heart and he will reject you. And he will reject you from his presence for all eternity in what the Bible calls hell. Why would you not want to follow a king who dies for you, who takes your place and who promises to never forsake you? Why would you want to keep rejecting such a king? Out of fear, out of boredom, out of pressure, out of self-rule. Why not make this Easter the Easter where you started seeing the cross for what it is, the beautiful cross that saves men and women like you and me. Why not in the quietness of your heart, either say sorry for where you have been rejecting Jesus, or if you are determined, maybe you're not a believer, and it's time now to take seriously, how are you going to respond? What do you need to do next? You need to start today and turn and follow Christ. You need to find out now that there's a number of booklets at the back of the church, just as you go out, that help you learn a little bit more about the cross or why Jesus, dead or alive. Take them, read them, but don't keep going on rejecting Jesus.